The only one who will really pay the tariffs, the impact of the tariffs, most likely will be Chinese consumers.
Trade wars intensify, as timing may help some. It's Monday, June 25th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Australia confronts forced marriage. Changes for Malaysia media. Indian Sikhs on patrol in New York. Safety from snakes and a time machine camera. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Retaliating against the Trump administration's tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, India has raised duties on 29 U.S. goods worth about $240 million. New Delhi made the announcement last week after Washington ignored its request to be exempted from the tariffs because its exports were tiny compared to others, such as China and the European Union. India accounts for about 2% of American imports of steel and aluminum, or $1.5 billion in sales. India is the latest country to hit back against U.S. President Donald Trump's tariff increases on steel and aluminum imports. Meanwhile, U.S. soybean farmers are waiting to see how the tariffs with China will impact their substantial exports to the world's second largest economy. John Bays of the U.S. Soybean Export Council tells VOA Mandarin reporter Monica Su that the initial impact appears to be minimal, which Chinese consumers seem to be facing the biggest inconvenience of higher prices.
Number one, we won't know if it really goes into effect until, I think it's 6th of July. So there's still opportunity for both sides to reach an agreement that avoids this. But if it does go into effect, I think the immediate effect will be relatively minor impact on the U.S. because we're exporting very few soybeans to China now, and we will export very few the rest of the year until about October. We normally don't export much until about October. If there's still an effect after October, then the U.S. undoubtedly will begin to export more soybeans to markets other than China, while South America in particular ships more to China. But it's interesting because a substantial importer into China was traveling in the Midwest, and he was met with a farmer, and that he said he did not expect China to import hardly any less soybeans from the U.S., than it did this year under the new tariff situation, because it cannot get what it wants from the rest of the world. And in fact, he said the only one who will really pay the tariffs, the impact of the tariffs, most likely will be Chinese consumers who have to pay more. And animal producers have to pay more for the soybean meal to feed their animals. So, that was his opinion, and he's a major importer. So it ultimately may not prove to be that big a deal with respect to soybeans, because China must import over 100 million tons of soybeans next year to supply its animal industry and to supply its food, soybean oil for the consumer, if it wants to feed the people and meet the standards of living which they have now. If it has to come to the U.S. to buy a large amount of soybeans and the tariffs are in place, then the government will collect a lot of revenue, but the people will have to pay for it in the form of higher prices.
You said the impact on soybean growers will be limited because right now it's a growing season, planting season, so there's some time for both sides to negotiate.
Right. The short-term impact on our exports will be relatively small. When it becomes a problem, maybe, is after we begin to really harvest our crop in September, and that crop meets the market and we need to export. But the problem is that Brazil harvested its crop. It's the primary supplier of soybeans to China is Brazil. It harvested its soybean crop beginning in January and February and March. It will not have another crop until February, March of next year. Its total exports are going to be about 72 million tons. So what does China do for soybeans after Brazil after its imports from Brazil run out, and you can't get any more from Brazil. The only place it's going to be able to get any quantity of any size is the U.S.
John Bays of the U.S. Soybean Export Council speaking with VOA Mandarin reporter Monica Hsu. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. Return of U.S.-Korean war vets remains draws nearer. Singapore says Trump-Kim summit cost just $12 million after some question on expenses. Malaysia's former Prime Minister Najib Razak net tightens. Former South Korean Prime Minister Kim Jong-pil dies. Pakistan Taliban named successor of chief killed in drone strike. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Campaigners are urging Australia to do more to stop forced marriages in its migrant communities. Since the practice was made illegal 5 years ago, more than 230 alleged cases have been referred to the Australian Federal Police, but there have been no prosecutions. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Since forcing an individual to marry was criminalised in Australia in March 2013, there have been no successful prosecutions. The police say that doesn't reflect the work they do to successfully prevent or disrupt forced marriages. Campaigners say most victims are girls under the age of 18, but many are unwilling to go to the authorities, fearing isolation or retribution from their families and communities. There's also a reluctance to speak to the police or start a criminal case against a relative or friend. Jennifer Byrne, the director of Anti-Slavery Australia, a campaign organisation, says the true scale of the problem is unknown.
I have no doubt that there are many more in the community who are unidentified, who are either in a forced marriage or facing a forced marriage.
Bial Daraj ran away from her home in Australia after two older sisters were forced to travel to Iraq to marry.
Seeing what they were going through really terrified me, and I didn't want to experience it. I argued as much as I can, stalled as much as I can, and then around 15, I just had enough and ran away because I knew, like, within a week I would have been married if I'd stayed at home.
Earlier this year, the Australian government announced a year-long trial to make it easier for victims to get help. Under the project, they can seek support without the involvement of the police. The government in Canberra states that forced marriage is a slavery-like practice, a form of gender-based violence and an abuse of human rights. Britain introduced a similar law to outlaw forced marriages in 2014, where the first prosecution has just finished. In Australia, this type of crime has affected women and girls from migrant Middle Eastern communities and others from Bangladesh, Afghanistan, India and Pakistan.
Phil Mercer is also following for us Australia's Human Rights Commission, which is setting up what it says is the world's first national inquiry into sexual harassment in the workplace. The independent investigation is partly in response to the Me Too movement, which showed the prevalence of women being sexually harassed and assaulted.
Intimidation and bullying of women at work in Australia is common, according to the Human Rights Commission. It's estimated that one in three women have been sexually harassed in this way, but experts believe much sexual misconduct isn't reported by women who fear a complaint could damage their careers. The commission said it was a persistent and pervasive problem in Australian workplaces. The inquiry, which will hold public consultations across the country, will investigate the causes of sexual harassment and the effectiveness of current laws and policies. The inquiry will be led by Australia's Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Kate Jenkins.
We have all the functions to make sure we can help Australia lead the globe on finding new solutions for sexual harassment.
The government says the year-long investigation is the first of its type anywhere in the world, because of its scope and scale, and also its oversight by the Australian Human Rights Commission, which was set up by the government in 1986 but operates independently. Australia's Minister for Women, Kelly O'Dwyer, says the inquiry will not only look at the causes of harassment and possible solutions, but also its financial consequences for victims.
It might mean that she loses her job, or it might mean that she's been denied promotions. This is not only a significant inquiry for us here in Australia, but there will probably be some learnings that other countries can take.
Australian law defines harassment as any unwelcome sexual conduct that causes an individual offence or humiliation. The Australian Human Rights Commission says the aim of its inquiry is to create a society where sexual harassment is unthinkable. It's due to make a series of recommendations in 12 months' time. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, senior U.S. officials met to discuss the suspension of joint military exercises of the U.S. and South Korea and have held for decades. But they were canceled following the Singapore summit earlier this month between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's a Monday morning. We're glad you're starting your week out with us here on VOA Asia. The surprising upset in Malaysia's May elections not only ushered in a new governing coalition, but it might also mean major changes for the media, which were largely under the previous government's control. Dave Grunbaum has the story for VOA from Petaling Jaya, Malaysia.
At the offices of the news site Malaysia Kini, there's enthusiasm about what might be a new dawn for press freedom in Malaysia.
I am pretty optimistic that, you know, somehow things will be different. Of course, it's still too early.
Too early to tell, because changes just started in the aftermath of the May elections, which marked the first victory by the opposition since Malaysia gained independence from Britain more than 60 years ago. For decades, the country's mainstream media was largely under the government's thumb. Political parties and businesses with ties to them and the government owned major press outlets. The government made it difficult for independent news outlets like Malaysia Kini, that did not toe the official line, to get licenses to broadcast and print newspapers as well as magazines.
It was definitely, you know, outright censorship, because the government could say to, and would say to, the print and the broadcasters, you cannot cover this.
A prime example, allegations of massive corruption against Prime Minister Najib Razak, who was ousted in the recent election. The mainstream media's coverage often played down or dismissed this issue. This prompted voters like Kevin Kaur to turn to alternative sources like Malaysia Kini.
People do generally do not trust the mainstream media before the general election. People will go to the alternative media on the internet to look for a better and fairer news report.
The new ruling coalition's campaign promises include free speech, but it's unclear if they'll stick with it. The current Prime Minister, Mahathir Mohamad, held the job once before from 1981 to 2003, a time when he did not have a rosy relationship with the media. Malaysia Kini has a press freedom wall that shows news outlets that have been shut down or suspended, including several during Mahathir's first stretch as Prime Minister.
It's pretty ironic, isn't it? I mean, you know, the fact that you have a Prime Minister now who during his first, you know, stint as Prime Minister is never known to be, you know, friendly to the media, definitely an enemy of the press. And the fact that he managed to win this second election, or to win this election to return as Prime Minister, he won it on the back of, you know, the free media, on the back of independent media.
Malaysia Kini pledges that it will be just as tough on the new regime as the old one. But what type of climate the press will face in this country is a story that cannot be written just yet. Dave Grunebaum for VOA News, Petaling Jaya, Malaysia.
Coming up, Indian Sikhs are helping New York City and its streets stay safe. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops.
So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. This news from VOA Asia. The U.S. military has relocated wooden coffins containing the remains of 100 American soldiers who have been missing from the 1950 to 1953 Korean War to the inter-Korean border in preparation for North Korea's eventual return of the remains to their home country. Visit VOA Asia Facebook today for all the best stories and features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, in New York, auxiliary police officers act as a liaison between communities and the police department. They assist about 36,000 regular officers maintaining law and order throughout New York's five boroughs. Recently, Gersach Kerr made headlines when she became the first female Sikh officer to serve in the auxiliary unit wearing a dastar, the traditional Sikh turban. Usually, dastars are worn by Sikh men, but some women choose to wear them to raise awareness about their religion. VOA reporter Anshuman Apte spoke to Gersach Kerr to learn why she made that choice and how the community is reacting to it.
Gersach Kerr joined the New York Police Department's auxiliary program when she was 20. She saw it as more than just a job. It also offered a perfect way to practice the selfless service that her faith, Sikhism, calls on its followers to do. Wearing a dastar, the turban usually worn by Sikh men, was another way to demonstrate her faith.
After I found out the significance of the turban, it's considered a crown, and then I figured, why not wear my crown if I'm given it? And it's a great opportunity of showing others and telling them who we are. And because I wear a turban, people ask questions, oh, why do you wear that? And from there, I'm able to tell them about my faith and why I follow it.
The auxiliary police is a voluntary force. Any New Yorker of legal age and status can join. Unlike the regular police, the auxiliaries don't carry guns, but they are trained in various skills, including self-defense, CPR, state law, and patrolling techniques. After finishing training, the auxiliary officers are deployed in various communities throughout the city.
The auxiliary officers are the eyes and ears of the police department. They assist the officers. If they see anything going on, they will call and, you know, to call police officers, and they will assist with you know, the officers with doing outreach to the community. They are the bridge between the community and the police department as well.
Kaur was born in America to Indian Sikh parents. Like her, most of the auxiliary officers come from immigrant backgrounds. They follow different religions and often speak other languages along with English.
For community members who may not speak English, having Gersach in the community is a big asset. She speaks Punjabi and can help them in their language. This is especially helpful for the elderly or those who have recently arrived here from Punjab, Delhi, or elsewhere.
The New York Police Department began allowing officers to wear turbans and keep beards in 2016. Kaur says her service to the NYPD while following her traditions not only helps allay misconceptions about immigrants, but also sends a powerful message of gender equality to the community.
It's a great message to the whole wide world that that the woman should be able to join any force they want and any field that they wish to join.
Besides serving the NYPD auxiliary police, Gersach Kerr is also pursuing her education. After graduating from college, she hopes to join the NYPD as a regular police officer. Anshuman Apte, VOA News, New York.
This news from VOA Asia. The net around embattled former Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak and his associates is tightening, with investigations into his administration's alleged misdeeds ratcheting up this past week. Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad declared Najib totally responsible for massive alleged fraud from a state fund. You'll find more on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, snakes. They slither on every continent on Earth except Antarctica. When poisonous snakes bite, you need help, fast. The Central American nation of Costa Rica is among the tropical countries in the world that has a very high concentration of snakes. 20 of that country's more than 130 species are among the most poisonous. VOA reporter Ecopia Luzzi traveled to Costa Rica to report on the work of a research institute that produces the snake bite antidotes, which in many cases are the only things that make a difference between life and death.
Costa Rica's Clodomiro Picado Institute produces anti-venom serums to counteract snake bites for use in Central America and elsewhere.
What makes the production of anti-venom serum complicated is that the snake venoms vary according to the region. So, anti-venom or anti-venom serums have to be specific for countries or regions.
Estimates vary, but at least 20,000 people die from snake bites every year, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia. To make the antidotes, the poison is extracted from the snakes manually by massaging the snake's head and collecting the fluid in a flask.
Here is all the venom.
In this room are some of the most dangerous snakes in the world. They could kill any adult within a few hours, so extracting the venom is a delicate process.
When you lose the respect and fear of the snake, that's when accidents can happen.
The other part of making the serum involves horses. One of the veterinarians at the institute explains that horses produce antibodies to the venom in their blood, which is extracted from anti-venom serum production. Researchers say this process is not painful for the animal.
Básicamente es por facilidad de manejo.
They handle themselves quite well. They learn to work. They get used to the work. And also because we can get large quantities, large volumes of blood, for profitable production.
The production of antidotes is a noisy task, but at the Clodomiro Picado Institute, the search for new cures against snake bites never stops. Jacopo Luzzi, VOA News, San Jose, Costa Rica.
It's happened to many of us. You fumble for your camera to record a precious moment, but you're a little too late. A delayed touch of the button, an opportunity missed forever. But now entrepreneurs in the Netherlands are hoping to change that dynamic with a new camera that can capture events even before you hit the record button. VOA's Julia Tabo gets in front of the story.
While George Wells could travel to the past and future in the 1960 movie The Time Machine, the reality of going back in time is still a fantasy. Or is it? A new camera may be making that dream a reality. A couple of Dutch entrepreneurs have developed the Rodar camera, which records what happened before the start button is activated, allowing users to capture milestone moments before they're lost forever. The camera is not actually recording all day, but is constantly buffering video.
This means that it remembers anything it sees just for a short while. And as soon as I see something that I would like to record, I press the camera like I do now, and it creates a clip that started 10 seconds before I pressed it.
The camera records the 10 seconds prior to being activated, as well as 10 seconds after being pressed. The 20-second clip is then automatically sent to the user's smartphone via Bluetooth. The camera has been in development for 2 years. One of the main design challenges was making it sufficiently energy efficient to continuously buffer.
So we programmed it that much that we only use a small amount of power, and the camera itself lasts for 7 hours, so you can use it almost all day.
The camera lens has a 120-degree field of view, compared with up to about 60 degrees on a standard smartphone camera. It's also got a built-in microphone and records video in two resolutions simultaneously. A low one for quick sharing on social media, and a higher resolution version that can be downloaded to a computer. The lanyard that holds the rotor around your neck doubles as a charging cable. The developers are currently in pre-production and final testing. They've launched the camera on the Indiegogo crowdfunding site and hope to have it ready for mass distribution by late this year. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find our program online at iTunes and SoundCloud. Also streaming on VOA Asia, Facebook, and our website, voanews.com. You'll find us, too, on the radio. We thank everyone who's tuned in to U-Radio of Hachai University, FM 101.25 at Hachai University in Thailand. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineers, Zainab Abdel-Rahman, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.